It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about. Tavis Ormandy's found another big flaw, this time in uTorrent, the BitTorrent client that a lot of people use. You may not want to use it after you hear about this. News from the iPhone hackers at Cellebrite. Apple's moving its databases to China. And Firefox 60 is losing its cookie management feature. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 652, recorded Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. WebAssembly. Security Now is brought to you by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/Security Now. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with the king, Stephen Gibson of GRC.com, the king of security.
Actually, I'm not sure who crowned me, Leo.
Yeah, but you wouldn't want that title, I don't think.
No, and besides, when you take the crown off, it leaves this line across your forehead. It's really annoying.
Ah, I hate it when
you
that
just
happens.
Don't want that.
I hate it.
Yeah.
Last show of February 2018.
It is indeed. I titled this WebAssembly not because I want to do a super extensive deep dive, but because a whole bunch of our listeners have asked me about it since I've been talking about the inefficiency of mining cryptocurrencies with JavaScript. They're all saying, well, what about WebAssembly? What about WebAssembly? So I thought, okay, let's talk about that, sort of put that into the proper context and like where that fits in terms of performance and so forth. So mostly we're just going to kind of wrap up with a like, what is WebAssembly? What are the benefits? Where does it stand? Where does it fit in the performance range and so forth? So I thought, okay, that's what we'll call this February 27th issue, 652 of the podcast. But other than that, we had a bunch of interesting news. We do have an update from Intel on the status of Spectre and Meltdown microcode. And there's a link in the notes, Leo, to a PDF you're going to want to open at some point, just probably for your own edification. I think our listeners will too, because it's the complete processor breakdown of, which is probably not the right word in this case, of where Intel stands with every single processor they have across their line in terms of the microcode updates. And so we're going to talk about that. Also, we have this week in crypto jacking, some news there. Tavis strikes again. Georgia on my mind, and not in a good way. News from the iPhone hackers at Cellebrite, or at least rumors. Also some concerns over Apple's announcement that it's going to be moving its Chinese customer data to China. A question about e-passports, which were mandated back in 2007, and something you're not going to believe. Also, Firefox 60, which is the next major release to come out, is losing a feature that I expect some of our listeners are going to be unhappy about. It kind of annoys me, but progress. We also have some news about the IRS and cryptocurrencies. Some good news about the next release of Android, which will be the P. And in some ways, it looks like it enhances privacy. So maybe P is for privacy, although I guess it has to be, what, pancakes or something. Then we also have some updates on malicious code signing, a very cool CloudFront Troy Hunt combo hack, which I think it's just very, very clever. Some errata, a little bit of miscellany, some closing the loop with our terrific listeners, and then we will wrap up by explaining where WebAssembly fits in the spectrum of browser-based code execution, because it's not the answer for cryptocurrency mining, but it's definitely an answer to something. So we'll figure that out.
We'll figure out what the question is in a bit.
And oh, another picture of the week, Leo. I just saw this one. Oh Lord,
it cracks me up.
Yeah.
It's got to be a joke, but maybe not.
I really think it has to be. I mean, it looks completely legitimate, but may be a hoax.
Yeah.
Although I think the one with the pail that they remember.
Yes,
this generator.
This is a series, an ongoing series.
Yeah. If nothing else, it's good for a hoop. So.
All of that coming up. But first, a word from our sponsor. We're brought to you today by WordPress.com. My blog's brought to you by WordPress. In fact, I love WordPress, and I have for years. Started using it when Matt Mullenweg first released it to the world. At the time, I ran my own server. I downloaded the software and ran it and all of that. And now I have to say I've discovered WordPress.com. I'm never going to do it again. I'm never doing it again. It's less expensive. It's easier. There's experts to help you. There's a whole community around it. WordPress.com, that's where my blog lives and where yours should too. Whether your website is for your business, sharing your voice, your work, whatever it is that, publicizing your latest venture, WordPress.com gives you the freedom and flexibility to do your own thing. And to do it right, to do it looking good. You don't need to do the coding or the design. WordPress provides all the tools you need to get your site up and running. It'll just take a few minutes. I mean, literally. There's a great customer support team there, 24/7, Monday through Friday. They're there on weekends as well to help you. Hundreds of themes to pick from, a complete e-commerce solution. In fact, they've got many options ranging from simple, just a buy button to a complete online store. You get to choose. And man, the price is right. As little as $4 a month. When you're ready to expand your business's online reach, WordPress makes it easy with built-in SEO, social sharing, specialized plugins. I turned on HTTPS comes with the site, but I also turned on AMP. The Akismet spam is anti-spam for comments is the best thing ever. I can go on and on. Nearly 30% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. Yeah, we're getting close to 30% now. Just amazing. I'm seriously love WordPress, and I know you're going to want to check it out. So go to wordpress.com/security now. Lots of answers to your questions there. And there's another reason you're going to want to go to wordpress.com/security now. 15% off your brand new website. Yeah. Any new plan purchase, 15% off. wordpress.com/security now to create your stunning website. Oh man, I love WordPress. Every time I blog there, I go, I'm so glad. What a relief. This is the best. wordpress.com/security now. Steve uses it. It's a good reason to do it.
I do. It's nice to have the problem solved.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, let's, some things, especially me, I want to get in and tweak every button dial.
I loved running my own server, but you find you spend all your time running your server.
Yep.
And it's kind of nice to put content up once in a while.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that if you tie into its anti-spam,
Akismet is great, isn't
trolling,
it?
Yes. Yeah. So, without you needing to do anything, thanks to the fact that it's got global visibility into what everybody is posting, spammers just don't show up in your blog comments.
Yeah.
So that's really a win. I've been staring at this picture of the week while you were telling us about WordPress. And I think I understand it better than I did before.
Well, I think anybody looking at it's going to get it pretty quickly, at least what the intent is, right?
Yes. Well, and of course the first one we ran across like this was that big motor generator that was near some railing, and there was a big green solid copper but green insulation for ground, wire coming off, wrapped around a pole, that was a metal pole that was then stuck into a big pitcher, you know, a bucket of dirt. And of course, we all had a lot of fun with that because, yeah, you know, some.
That some one looked person, like somebody believed it would work.
Yes. It looked like they actually thought, okay, I'm grounding this generator,
yeah,
you know.
And we should mention, it might even be easier to understand if you use the British term for it, which is Earth.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We're sending it to Earth.
Yes. And sometimes we use both, an Earth ground.
Yeah.
So, okay, so looking, so just for the our listeners who can't see this, here we have kind of off of the image is some big high power switch box thing.
Yeah.
And we're just seeing the lower right hand side of it.
Yeah.
But then, as code requires, apparently, coming out from a nice grommeted connector is this yellow and green striped wire that is clearly meant to be ground. It goes into some other thing that probably some other code requires, and then out it comes again through an anchoring post, and then into a rather small size plastic bag.
It's a one-quart Ziploc bag with dirt in it.
Yeah, a sandwich would not really fit in this thing. And it's got some dirt in it. And then to in case somebody wasn't, you know, didn't
Why is that dirt hanging from the power box?
Exactly. There's also a round yellow sticker with the famous ground symbol on it.
Yeah.
You know, the line coming down with three horizontals of like in a triangle.
This is our ground.
So you clearly know. So and at first I was thinking, okay, this looks just like, you know, cause like really, but I realized then that backing that we're seeing looks like it's metal. It's all like sheet aluminum because we can see a rivet over on the right hand side.
Yeah.
So and then if you look at that, the wire coming out is like there's a post in the steel or this aluminum or whatever it is.
That's the real ground, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's the point. Is this entire back sheet is itself properly grounded, and so the wire comes out and just, you know, attaches to a post, an electrically conductive post, and then somebody was having some fun, and so they said, okay, or maybe they wanted to make it clear to somebody looking at it that the whole back sheet was a ground, so they came up with this little kind of cartoonish thing just to sort of say, look, you know, yes, you can't tell, but the whole backing sheet is hooked to earth, and so we're just going to hang a little bag of dirt here and connect it up, just, you know, to drive that point home visually. That's anyway, funny. A fun picture.
Yeah.
Okay, I talked about this PDF. I've got the link in the show notes. I think if you were to Google microcode update guidance, that's from the URL of the newsroom.intel.com, where our friend there is still referring to himself in the first person. Anyway, I think that will probably take you to the update. So this was released last week with the latest news of where Intel is in this slog that they're in, this trek to produce new microcode for like across their entire product family. The announcement that goes along with this PDF states that Intel has now released production microcode updates to our OEM customers and partners for Kaby Lake and Coffee Lake based platforms, plus additional Skylake based platforms. This represents their 6th, 7th, and 8th generation Intel Core product lines, as well as their latest Intel Core X series processor family, also includes their recently announced Xeon Scalable and Xeon D processors. Now, the problem is Intel's got a ton of processors. And so this PDF does allow someone to go in and figure out what the heck, you know, like, is theirs there yet? Now, this doesn't mean these are available to end users. And I noted in some of the coverage on the net that Intel had not yet updated that Linux package, which would allow someone would allow Linux systems to dynamically patch their microcode. And I don't remember, Leo, a couple weeks ago, I ran across some news that Windows had the ability to do microcode patching. And I don't remember if I ever mentioned it on the podcast. There are two DLLs in the Windows System 32 directory whose names make it very clear they are for Intel and AMD microcode patching. And so this suggests that if Microsoft wished to, they could perhaps do this, although that seems like more responsibility than they're going to want to take. Anyway, so what I was going to say was that this is the release of this microcode to Intel's OEM customers like Lenovo and Dell and, you know, everybody else, not to end users. Linux end users can potentially get this as soon as Intel updates the Linux package, but the rest of us are going to have to wait. But at least this, for anyone who's interested or for whom this may be mission critical, this indicates, you know, where this updated PDF indicates where Intel is in the process. And what, maybe a third, maybe a quarter of the listings there. There's lots of beta and pre-beta and in planning, which means not yet in production. The label production in that one column is the only one that says, yes, we've pushed this out the door and we're not going to pull it back again, hopefully. I'm sure they learned their lesson from the first round. So anyway, they're moving forward, and as soon as the OEMs are able to, you know, verify that it works and test it, and I think what we'll see then is another round of BIOS updates, which we as end users will then be able to download and run on our laptops and desktops in order to get this this Spectre variant 2 is the one that, you know, is the kind of the nastiest one that's been causing all the trouble. Meltdown, that got fixed pretty easily. The variant 1 of Spectre was not a big problem. This is the really nasty one is variant 2, which, you know, we're now still sort of waiting for final fixes for. I thought, okay, I'm going to call this week in cryptojacking. And by the way, I thought I had coined a fun term last week, mal mining. That's still not bad.
No, I like it. Yeah.
Yeah, mal mining. Except that cryptojacking, I guess, is already become the official term. So mm-hmm. I was late to the party with mal mining, although it makes it a little more clear, I think. I like mine a little bit better. Anyway, and a group called Redlock Cloud Security Intelligence, or Redlock CSI, they discovered that Tesla, our Tesla Corporation, had become the latest victim of cryptojacking. They started their report by saying, "We are beginning to witness the evolution of cryptojacking as hackers recognize the massive upside of these attacks and begin to explore new variations to evade detection." Okay, so what happened is, in the case of Tesla, this wasn't some massive corporate-wide infiltration, but there was something misconfigured, as so often is the case. They discovered that one of Tesla's Kubernetes consoles, believe it or not, was not password protected. It was just wide open. Kubernetes, I know I've heard you use the term before, Leo. For those of our listeners who don't know, it's an open source platform originally developed by Google, which has now then been released and is independently maintained and further developed by the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. And essentially, it's an automation system for Linux containers, which eliminates a lot of the manual processes involved in deploying and scaling containerized Linux apps. So sort of a meta container management console, and you need to give it a password. Apparently, there was an unsecured Kubernetes pod, as it's called, that was Tesla's. By getting into that, and I saw a screenshot of this in as I was digging around, there just is plain as day were the two Amazon S3, the simple storage service, the ID and the key.
Oh, no. Just in like in a picture?
Just right there.
Oh.
Right on the console. Welcome screen.
Of course, that's the secret key. If you give it out, you have access to those buckets, right?
Yes, yes. That is, that's what you have to absolutely protect.
That's your password, basically.
Yes, yes,
oh,
it is.
Criminy.
So there was exposure of sensitive data, and I saw a reference to telemetry, but it wasn't clear what telemetry, and it really isn't important. What was interesting was that in addition to that data exposure, as a consequence of having access to this console, the hackers were performing they were able to run crypto mining, but of a slightly different nature or sort of more professional than we've seen before. They were using a number of advanced evasion techniques in order to keep from being discovered. It didn't keep them from being discovered ultimately, but it's interesting that we're seeing this sort of next generation evolution. For example, they weren't just running something from coinhive.com. They did not use a well-known public mining pool, which is like the easy thing to do. You just run some mining pool software and point to a public mining pool. The problem is then you have well-known, well-identified endpoint for your traffic, and it's easy to catch. Instead, they installed their own mining pool software and then configured the malicious script to connect to an unlisted semi-public endpoint. They even used an IP address for the mining pool software behind Cloudflare, because whenever you register for a CDN, you get an IP. And this allowed them to use an IP that could be changed at will and was floating around. So, not locked down. They also went to the effort of using a non-standard port, so they were off the radar, and the RedLock people who saw this all running noted that the CPU was not near pinned. So these guys, whoever the bad guys were who set this up, they went to some lengths to install something which would be able to run large, probably undetected for a long time. They basically created their own command and control infrastructure so that would not be easily found from scanning or typical behavior, and then didn't want to give themselves away by going full bore, cranking up the CPU usage, because that could draw attention to them. So they were taking some percentage of the CPU for mining, but probably hoped to just sit there and mine quietly for the duration of however long they could get. So I think that the way that the take these guys had, the RedLock folks had, is exactly right. That what we're going to begin seeing, what we're going to be seeing, is an evolution in the seriousness of crypto jacking or malmining, to use my term, that is serious. You know, through the years, viruses never made anyone any money. They were just sort of curiosities. They were annoying. They propagated. They were sort of, you know, in the domain of hackers who you sort of wondered, well, why are they doing this? What's the point of, like, and we just sort of, oh, look, you know, I can screw around with the world's computers by creating a virus and seeing how far it goes or how long it lives or something. But they weren't money making. But then, as we saw a couple years ago, when this idea of crypto, you know, cryptography based ransomware occurred, where you could arrange to create a key where each instance's key was unique, and you were able to use public key crypto in order to encrypt someone's files and then hold them at ransom. That we saw a change then. Suddenly, there was a way to make money potentially from these kinds of, I mean, the same kinds of viruses and games that were being played before, suddenly dollars. And of course, now we have real world currency, exchangeable cryptocurrencies. So this is not just virtual money. This is money you can buy things with. So now what we're seeing is the next evolution of this is that now it's possible to monetize the theft of idle CPU resources, which arguably exist everywhere. I mean, you know, everything that's on the net has a computer behind it. And suddenly, I mean, sadly, light bulbs, you know, are, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff have, you know, all of our IoT stuff may not have much power, but, you know, there's strength in numbers. So I really think we're going to begin to see, well, we are seeing, and I think it's going to continue. I see no sense that it's going to reverse. I remember when we first saw the tip of the ransomware iceberg years ago, you know, on this podcast, we said, uh-oh, this is not good. This is now you can get paid for infecting and encrypting someone's computer. That creates incentive. And I think the same pressure, the same leveraging of our unfortunately porous security is going to create, I guess, what we would call intrusion pressure to get into systems exactly like this, find something and just begin setting up little mining operations wherever you can and participate in a pool and start generating revenue. I you know, in the same way that the first sign of the ransomware, you know, sort of gave us this sense that, uh-oh, that we're going to be seeing more of this. And of course we did. I think we're entering a new world where the ability to monetize idle CPU resources like other people's, because remember that it's depending upon where you are, it is and how and what technology you're using. There's so much competition for mining now that the cost of electric power is oftentimes greater than your ability to mine a given cryptocurrency. That is, your electric bill goes up more than cryptocurrency comes into a wallet. Again, depending upon where you are, because there's a huge variation, at least in the U.S., in the cost of electricity. And depending upon the size of your installation, you did that power, a percentage of that electrical power is not just going to computation, it's going to heat, where there's a lot of heat generated. So now you have to somehow get the heat out of the environment. So you have to pay for air conditioning too, you know, classic data center operations. So The point is, you don't want to use your own power. It's not profitable. You want to steal power from other people, even, no matter how inefficient it is, because you're not paying for it. They are. Anyway, I think this is going to be like the 2018 is going to be the year of the rise of this intrusion pressure. That is, we've talked about how porous security is, that if somebody really wants to get in, they can push and push and scan and probe and fish and, you know, use social engineering. I mean, the more you want to get in, the greater the probability is you can. And the idea that there's a profit, potentially long-term persistent profit. Think about, for example, the fact that the internet is all full of this background radiation that we've talked about, that Code Red and NIMDA worms are still out there scanning around. Well, they could be mining cryptocurrency for the last decade. Well, it hasn't been around for the last decade. But the point is, there is an opportunity to set up long-term residents stealing power from somebody's closet. You know, who knows where these things are? Anyway, I think this week in crypto jacking or malmining, I guess I have to settle on a term one of these days. That's going to be an ongoing theme, I think, for the podcast. Tavis, our illustrious Google Project Zero security researcher, peered into uTorrent, and we can pretty much predict the rest. As we know, uTorrent, is it pronounced uTorrent or MicroTorrent?
I say MicroTorrent. I think the U is supposed to be the micron symbol, right?
Yeah, that's always sort of been a...
Yeah, I think I always say MicroTorrent.
Okay, good. So, and of course, that is BitTorrent's official peer-to-peer file torrenting application, which is in use, I mean, by many millions of active users every day. I mean, it's the internet's number one peer-to-peer torrent application. After checking into the way MicroTorrent operated last November, Tavis, on behalf of Google's Project Zero, not surprisingly, found some problems, actually some bad problems, and reached out to BitTorrent. There's another instance maybe of him not knowing who to contact, or them not knowing who he was, or being busy, or who knows what is going on at BitTorrent, but he didn't get any dialogue with them, despite the fact that what he found was a relatively easily exploitable remote execution vulnerability in MicroTorrent, which, whoops, that's not good. So finally, he, as the clock was ticking, remember that Google's Project Zero gives companies 90 days to repair from the time they are notified, feeling that that should be enough time for anyone to respond with a fix to a security vulnerability, yet still protect users by not making it 2 years, make it 3 months. So last week, Tavis sent another tweet to BitTorrent's original creator, Bram Cohen, who's now doing cryptocurrency stuff. And he tweeted, "I don't think BitTorrent are going to make a 90-day disclosure deadline. Do you have any direct contacts who could help? I'm not convinced they understand the severity or urgency." Well, turns out that BitTorrent had been listening, just hadn't been corresponding. A fix, and I've got that in quotes in my notes because they didn't fix it, for the problem is currently in the beta channel, but not yet in a stable release. Well, Tavis is not impressed, and he wrote in the Project Zero blog. He said, "It looks like BitTorrent just added a second token to MicroTorrent Web that does not solve the DNS rebinding issue, and that's what it was that Torrent found was a vulnerability with that could be exploited through DNS rebinding. He said, it just broke my exploit, meaning that unfortunately they prevented the one thing that Tavis found, or well, the one example Tavis gave them, but didn't fix the underlying problem. They muted the symptom, essentially, rather than curing the disease. And in this case, the disease appears to be significant. What Tavis wrote in the blog was, he said, by default, MicroTorrent creates an HTTP RPC, that's a remote procedure call server on port 10,000. That's in MicroTorrent Classic, or on port 19575, and that's not a secret. That's well known in MicroTorrent Web. He says there are numerous problems with these RPC servers that can be exploited by any website using, and then he uses the JavaScript function. It's XML HTTP request, which is a way for code running on a page to generate requests for various assets. Although, I guess I think you would need to mess around with DNS, because normally you would have some same origin protections. But anyway, he says, to be clear, visiting any website is enough to compromise these applications. And he says in his notes, as the name suggests, MicroTorrent Web uses a web interface and is controlled by a browser as opposed to the desktop application. By default, MicroTorrent Web is configured to start up with Windows, so will always be running and accessible. Essentially, it's like a server running in the background, and then if you want to, you can fire up a web browser and connect to this server running in your machine on the local host port in order to configure it and, you know, drop in requests for it to torrent files. He says, for authentication, a random token is generated and stored in a configuration file, which must be passed as a URL parameter with all requests. Okay, so that sort of sounds good. At installation, it invents a random token, and then that's got to be present in the request URL. He says, when you click the MicroTorrent tray icon, a browser window is opened with the authentication token populated, and he gives an example of it. Standard localhost URL. He says, while not a particularly strong secret, it at least would make remote attacks non-trivial. He says, unfortunately, however, the authentication secret is stored inside the web root, meaning you can just fetch the secret like by asking for http://127.0.0.1:19575/, which is the root of the server. And it returns it to you. So, and actually he said, WTF !!! And he repeats that a few times. So he says, you could just fetch the secret and gain complete control of the service.
That's pretty funny, actually. A browser could do that. I mean, JavaScript, yes, in a browser, or a website, obviously. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Wow. Exactly. It's just nuts. So the takeaway for our listeners is, be very careful.
Don't run MicroTorrent, I think, would be
the
takeaway.
There's no way this is safe.
Yeah.
Because if you were to go to a malicious website, it could use XML HTTP request in order to determine the secret token and then issue commands. And he goes a little bit further, because he says, once you have the secret, you can just change the directory which torrents are saved to, then download any file anywhere which is writable in the system, meaning you can replace I mean, you can essentially a remote attacker who uses this vulnerability in MicroTorrent can cause your MicroTorrent instance to go get a file and place it anywhere in the system. So, you know, the first one would be something malicious, and the second one would be an auto start invocation in your auto run tree. I mean, it's just crazy what this could do. So, yes, not safe. And they didn't respond. They didn't actually fix the problem. They just sort of sidestepped it. So this certainly turns up the heat. I certainly, anyone using MicroTorrent, I would say don't leave it running. You know, by as Tavis said, by default, it just comes up and sort of runs as a service.
That's how you normally do it, yeah.
Yeah. So I would say don't leave it running when you're not using it. Use it carefully and be looking for updates from BitTorrent that convinces you that this has been fixed in the right way. Or maybe I think I have a link in the do I have a link in the notes to what Tavis wrote? I have a link to a 260blog.com story that talks about this from and I followed that down into Tavis's postings on Google Project Zero. So there is certainly a way to get that. And I would say wait, you know, I would wait until Tavis acknowledges in his blog that they finally got this thing fixed, because yikes. So in a move that is very worrisome, Georgia, the U.S. state of Georgia is moving. It's already passed the Senate. It's now in the House to criminalize independent computer security research. I don't know if in the last year there have been many podcasts where I have said, please, please, please don't let this ever happen. This will be the worst thing that ever happened. So this is a bill to be entitled, is the way this bill reads, an act to amend, you know, this is all legalese, part one of Article 6 of Chapter 9 of Title 16. Of the official code of Georgia annotated. And it says, related to computer crimes, so as to create the new crime of unauthorized computer access, to provide for penalties, to change provisions relating to venue for computer crimes, to provide for forfeiture, to provide for related matters, to repeal conflicting laws, and for other purposes. And I found the bill on February 12th, a couple weeks ago. The bill passed the Georgia Senate and is now in the House. The language of the bill says, one, as defining unauthorized computer access, any person who accesses a computer or computer network with knowledge that such access is without authority shall be guilty of the crime of unauthorized computer access, with no caveats, no exceptions, no research, no responsible disclosure, no academics, nothing. Just if you access a computer or computer network with knowledge that such access is without authority, which is sort of the definition of checking the security of something. It's like, you know, knock, knock.
You mind if I hack your server?
Door just swung open by itself. Then, because they're not totally insane, but this doesn't help much, 2.2 in the bill says, this subsection shall not prohibit a parent or legal guardian of an individual who is under the age of 18 from monitoring computer usage. Denying computer usage.
Thank God.
Jesus.
Whoa, that's good. Oh, that's a relief.
Or copying data from such individual's computer. And then it says, all laws and parts of laws in conflict with this act are repealed.
Wow.
There are no exceptions or exemptions for the intent of the unauthorized access, nor for the responsible disclosure of any vulnerabilities which might be found. So, as a consequence, honest researchers risk prosecution for verifying. Anyway, as you can imagine, the EFF has blown a gasket over this. They're all over it. There's an EFF branch in Georgia.
Is this a law, or they're considering it?
This is about to get passed.
It's not yet a law. Okay.
No, I saw the voting. It was about 2/3 to 1/3 in the Senate.
Because these people don't know what the hell they're thinking. You know, they don't know what this means. No
idea.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, oh, God. So, you know, again, I mean, I don't know if we're going to – I guess this is where having a federal government comes in, where we have the – you know, the federal government creates something that –
Fortunately, they're so much smarter. This will be no problem at all.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Anyway, so, I mean, this is horrible, obviously. I'll keep an eye on it. We'll see if the EFF is able to, you know, maybe it'll be challenged, you know, who knows?
Remember, this is the state where it's illegal to teach evolution. I mean, I don't, you know.
Correct.
I think we're, if you got to wonder which industry is pushing this. I wonder if Diebold is in Georgia. Somebody's in Georgia that doesn't want to be revealed.
Well,
you know.
And you pronounced it correctly. I have one of
yes, one, I know. I saw that too.
one of our errata is somebody who's really just blown a gasket. Speaking of, over me pronouncing Diebold.
I think I said it wrong too. So I said that's why I threw it in just to show you.
Yep. Thank you. So we don't have as a consequence of the nature of this so-called industry of iPhone cracking, we don't have definitive information from Cellebrite, and we're not going to. But all of the evidence suggests that Cellebrite may now be able to unlock from iPhone 5 through iPhone 10. I mean, inclusive. All of them. There was some good coverage in Forbes. Thomas Fox Brewster, writing in his security column for Forbes, he says, in what appears to be a major breakthrough for law enforcement, and again, with caveats that, you know, we don't know absolutely positively for sure, but it's worth just putting it on everyone's radar, and a possible privacy problem for Apple customers. He writes, a major U.S. government contractor claims to have found a way to unlock pretty much every iPhone on the market. Cellebrite, the Israeli-based vendor that's become the U.S. government's company of choice when it comes to unlocking mobile devices, is this month telling customers its engineers currently have the ability to get around the security of devices running iOS 11. That includes the iPhone X, a model that Forbes has learned was successfully raided for data by the Department of Homeland Security back in November 2017, so last November, most likely with Cellebrite technology. He writes, the Israeli firm, a subsidiary of Japan's Sun Corporation, hasn't made any major public announcement about its new iOS capabilities, but Forbes was told by sources who asked to remain anonymous as they weren't authorized to talk on the matter that in the last few months, the company has developed undisclosed techniques to get into iOS 11 and is advertising them to law enforcement and private forensics folk across the globe. Indeed, he writes, the company's literature for its, quote, advanced unlocking and extraction services offering now notes the company can break the security of, quote, Apple iOS devices and operating systems, including iPhone, iPad, iPad Mini, iPad Pro, and iPod Touch running iOS 5 to iOS 11. So then Thomas's column goes into much greater detail, citing interesting but, you know, necessarily hearsay accounts of various models of iPhones being accessed. But as always, you know, without absolute definitive detail. But of course, that's because Cellebrite protects these secrets as much from Apple as it as like from their own customers. You know, they could probably put this in some software. They might be able to package it in something that they sell, but Apple would be first in line to purchase it through a cutout and figure out what Cellebrite is doing, and assuming that they really wanted to, fix the problem. So the way this works is phones must be physically sent to Cellebrite for them to work their magic. And then they either unlock and extract or provide some means subsequently for after the phone is returned, for, probably for forensics reasons, to allow the authority that had had that device in their possession to then get access to it. So, again, this is hearsay and rumor. Seems to be pretty well sourced, however. So who knows, you know, what they're doing, what in they may have found. But it does look like if this is to be believed, there may be a way in, given, you know, this sort of extreme access where you have to have, you know, it has to go to Israel in order to be cracked. Also on the Apple front, following Microsoft with Azure and their Office 365 services and Amazon, Apple is complying with a new Chinese law which requires the data for Chinese citizens to reside in China. So for all of these companies, it's a matter of either complying with, you know, Chinese law or losing the Chinese market, which none of them are willing to do. Greater China is Apple's second most important market after the U.S., which generated in its most recent fiscal year $44.76 billion in revenue, which is a fifth of Apple's total revenue for the year. So China's number two, and Apple's not about to say, you know, no, just because they're not willing to relocate their data. What has stirred some controversy is that Apple has indicated explicitly that it also intends to store the encryption keys for its Chinese users in China, whereas neither Microsoft nor Amazon have said one way or the other. They've declined to comment. So for privacy advocates, of course, this raises understandable concerns because they worry that China may become heavy-handed once it has the data and the keys under its own control. In some coverage of this, a Beijing-based attorney who was asked about the decision said that Chinese iPhone users are disappointed by Apple's changes to iCloud data storage because privacy protection in China is weak. However, he said that the iPhone users still consider that iPhone is better than some other pure Chinese-made phones for privacy and policy protection, which I think is a sane position to have. So Apple partnered with a provider, and I had no idea how to pronounce it. It's Guizhou, but the internet came to my aid. It looks like it's Guizhou is the way you pronounce it. And so the Guizhou company, Guizhou?
Z-H-O is Joe, yeah.
Oh, very nice. Thank you, Lee. Okay,
or actually, Guizhou is probably how they would say it. But
Guizhou. Okay, good. Yeah. Anyway, so it's the company's name is Guizhou on the Cloud Big Data Industry Company, or just for short, Guizhou Cloud. It's overseen by the government of the Guizhou province. Apple plans to shift they said operational responsibility for all iCloud data for Chinese customers in China tomorrow. That is by February 28th, tomorrow. Although not the data. Customer data will be migrated to servers there over the course of the next 2 years. Apple really does sound like it's being as responsible as it can be under the circumstances. They've first of all declined to say when the encryption keys would move, and they began notifying iCloud users in China last month that their data would be moved into China. Updated terms and conditions for China users say that Apple and this Guizhou Cloud will have access to all data and the right to share, exchange, and disclose all user data, including content, to and between each other under applicable law. The Reporters Without Borders group has urged journalists in China to change their geographic region or close their accounts before tomorrow, worrying that Chinese authorities could gain a backdoor to user data even if Apple says it won't provide one. And Apple, for its part, again, I think continuing to do as much as they can, has said that it has advised Chinese customers that they can opt out of iCloud service to avoid having their data stored in China, and that data for Chinese-based users whose settings are configured for another country or for Hong Kong or Macau won't go to Chinese servers. And Apple said it won't transfer anyone's data until they have accepted the new mainland China terms of service. So I think they're doing everything that they can. And, you know, this is the nature of a global network and, you know, the autonomy that countries have over, their own citizens. So
we should point out that the Chinese could still go to Apple in the current situation and ask for the keys through the American courts. And more importantly, if you're American, this is a clear indication that Apple has the capability of unencrypting your iCloud data and will do so if offered an appropriate subpoena or warrant, which, you know, people, I think, you know, when I mentioned this on Twit, people went, what? I said, yeah, Apple kind of implies that they're secure and encrypted. But no, your iCloud stuff, they can see it, just like Dropbox and most cloud storage stuff. And we've talked in the past about why that is.
Yes, and I think you're very right to disambiguate iCloud from iPhone, because, you know, what it is that Apple says they absolutely cannot get into is your iPhone. But I remember in the case of even back in the San Bernardino case, if that person's phone had been backed up to iCloud, then Apple said, yeah, you know, we
Apple
can
literally
provide the data.
Told the FBI, oh, geez, if you just told us ahead of time, we'd have told you this.
Right.
We can't unlock the phone. Now, I wonder, given that Apple's done everything they can to make sure that they can't get into the phone, why they still persist in keeping the keys for iCloud? Probably because functionally, trust no one encryption on a cloud storage service eliminates, as we've talked about before, a lot of features, right? That's why.
Yes, there are lots of things you cannot do that Apple needs to do. If nothing else, probably like recovery. If you know they're now backing up you're able to back up your iOS devices to the cloud, then it gets run over by a tractor.
Right.
Okay, so now you really need it back. Yeah, so you may need Apple's help.
Customers want it. In fact, we talked before about how Apple's kind of stepped back a little bit in the amount of security they have on those phones. Because customers are saying, well, I can't get my password.
Well, in fact, we will soon be talking about Squirrel. And I was teasing people, a week before last that I would have an announcement to make. It's not something you can download yet, but it is done. I'm in the process of adding a visual monitor screen to the secret data block for us in the GRC news group to use to watch the app's use of secret data so that we can absolutely visually verify that it is being proactively wiped from memory. The only way I know to do that is just to like actually see it and watch it disappear the moment you're finished with an operation. So during the final wrap up, I need to go through and check the jargon that the app uses, reread the terminology to make sure it's consistent. But I mean, we're there. This comes up in this instance, Leo, because the whole point of Squirrel is there's no recourse. There's no one if you refuse to back up your identity, if you refuse to print out something that we help you print out, if you refuse, then okay. The whole point of it is TNO, you know, that you are responsible. There's ways you can recover your identity, but you really just have to do a couple things in the beginning, then you're completely recoverable. But there is no third party. And so it remains to be seen whether that is too much responsibility for people to have. Maybe it is. You know, I mean, maybe people don't really care about their security that much. We'll find out. But, you know, what has been built now is a system that at least says, okay, we built a workable system that is between you and the websites you visit. You can very securely authenticate your identity in a way that breaches at the server can't expose passwords or email addresses or any, you know, Squirrel gives websites no secrets to keep. So they don't have anything that they have to worry about protecting from disclosure. But the flip side is there's no third party to go crying to if you forget your master password, although there's lots of recovery available. So anyway, yes, Leo. So I think you're right. I think that Apple has sliced this carefully and deliberately so that they are able to help people recover the contents of their phones and their photos, you know, like yeah. their life's collection of photos if they need to.
Right. Right.
And, you know, they're always being prompted to increase your iCloud storage. I'm still within the minimum, but just because I'm kind of persnickety about that, I imagine a lot of people just say, oh, sure, I'll pay a little more
Apple
per month.
Apple pushes you to back up your phone to iCloud.
Yeah.
Which means even if your phone is encrypted, as they pointed out to the FBI in the San Bernardino case, your iCloud's not.
Yep. Yep. Well, it is, but they are able to access
it. Yeah, it's encrypted.
Yeah.
So, sort of.
Yeah. Okay, now you're not going to believe this one. Introduced and mandated more than a decade ago, and you travel a lot, so I'm sure you have one, back in 2007, so 11 years ago, all newly issued passports must now be e-passports, as they're called. And I'm sure you've got one, and you've got a little chip in yours, right?
Yep, a little RFID chip in it.
Yep.
It's in the spine.
Citizens of the 38 countries on the visa waiver list must have an e-passport in order to be admitted to the U.S. And, of course, U.S. citizens have to have one when traveling abroad. These e-passports have an electronic chip containing cryptographic information and machine-readable text, which makes it very easy to verify a passport's authenticity and integrity, or at least so goes the theory. CPB, the Customs and Border Protection, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, is the division of the U.S. that is in charge of this. And this, the border staff have long since deployed e-passport readers at most ports of entry, because it makes reading the data out of the passports and automatically and electronically logging the passport data easier, quicker, and more efficient. Okay, now get this. Although all e-passport data has been cryptographically digitally signed from the beginning, Customs and Border Protection has never, doesn't today, never has had the software necessary to authenticate the information stored on the e-passport chips. Oh, I kid you not.
So they just take for whatever you say. They go, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fine.
So it can be forged at will, and it's super encrypted, super secret, cannot be forged. So they just, I mean, now you're more vulnerable to forgery, because this is the unforgeable, cryptographically signed e-passport system, which doesn't check the signature.
Well,
somehow, oh,
that makes it easier.
Somehow this fell across. Yeah, exactly. Oh, that was,
in other words, as Anarite says in the chat room, fake e-passports are just like fake regular passports. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, except worse.
Feature parody. Yeah,
because they're impossible to forge, right? So
yeah,
they're more strongly believed,
right,
if it's an e-passport,
yeah,
because it's all crypto, hey, something just magical,
yeah,
except it isn't, and it never has been. So somehow, wow, this fell across the radar of Senators Ron Wyden, thank goodness he's there, and Claire McCaskill, who wrote to U.S. Customs and Border Protection Acting Commissioner Kevin K. I didn't pronounce this ahead of time. McAllenan. I can't pronounce his name.
I'm not gonna,
anyway,
I think it's Guizhou. I think it is.
Not even Chinese.
I think McAllenan is what I would say.
Oh, thank you. McAllenan. Okay. I like
McAllenan.
There you go.
Yeah.
See, yes. Kevin K. McAllenan for clarification of this rumor. And demanding some attention. In their letter, they said CBP does not have the software necessary to authenticate the information stored on the e-passport chips. Specifically, CBP cannot verify the digital signatures stored on the e-passport, which means that CBP is unable to determine if the data stored on the smart chips has been tampered with or forged, in their letter stated. And the CBP has been aware of this glaring lapse since at least 2010, when the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, released a report highlighting the gap in technology. So, you know, we know what that means. What that means is there was somewhere back in 2007, there was a public and private key pair that was created. And anyone who is minting one of these passports has super secret private control of this private key.
Of course they do.
So the data for the passport is hashed, and the digest, the hash of the data, is then cryptographically signed with the super secret private key, which nobody else has. And every e-passport, and you know, since passports can come from different places, there must be a collection of private keys, any one of which can be used to sign. Okay, then on the border entry side, you would have this device which reads the data, performs the hash of the data, and then uses the matching or one of the matching public keys to decrypt the stored signature and verify that the hashes match. And none of them do that. They never have. So anybody has been able to forge, alter the data in the passports, and it would never be noticed. So, you know, maybe someday. It's been 11 years. Maybe we'll get around to doing that.
It couldn't be that hard.
I would. Oh, Leo, you know, our browsers do it.
I know.
I mean, no, it's trivial.
Yeah.
I mean, that's you know, every web browser that all of us have has the ability to verify that certificate that we receive from a website.
Yeah.
No, can't everybody else can do it except Customs and Border Protection.
Oh, Lord.
Incredible.
Wow.
I mentioned at the top of the show that Firefox would be losing a feature that some old techie curmudgeons might grumble about. The next release, we're at 57 point something or other right now. The next major release is thus 60. And the Firefox nightly build, which is currently at 60, has made some changes to cookie management. In other words, it's disappeared. We've been seeing this trend in Firefox for a while. It sort of disappeared from the UI where it used to be present. And then I remember going looking for it, even like, you know, a year ago. It was like, where'd they hide this? And you have to, like, you have to change the history. It's under your history settings for some reason. And it's like, what? Okay. So you go, you say, okay, like custom history settings. And then out of the UI drops some ability to still see into what cookies you've got. You can browse them, you can delete them, you can basically audit them. That's disappearing. Now, I'm hoping that for those who this really upsets, there may be a browser plugin you would be able to add to recover cookie management if you really have to have it. But I also think this sort of represents a trend, you know, in just sort of the general popularizing of the, you know, and user-friendlyizing of the net. I mean, what percentage of, I'm sure they have instrumentations, you know, telemetry on this that says, okay, you know, Steve and four other people in the U.S. last month, you know, looked at their cookies. So, okay. So not enough to have that still in the UI. So, and we're beginning to see this where lesser used features are being pruned over time. So for what it's worth, Firefox moving forward, we lose the ability to audit our cookies. Maybe if there's I mean, I'm a little surprised because Firefox has also sort of been the techie user's friendly browser. So it'll be interesting to dig into this deeper and see what the story is. But it has been confirmed that we're losing the ability to manage cookie settings and remove individual cookies in Firefox with the next release. Under nothing certain besides death and taxes, Coinbase has informed 13,000 of its users that their data will be sent to the IRS soon, within 21 days. They fought an IRS order, which was first made back in November of 2016, asking for Coinbase's records of all people who bought Bitcoin from 2013 to 2015, specifically.
How about selling Bitcoin for dollars?
Yeah, I'm not sure. So
bought Bitcoin. They'd want to know who got dollars as opposed to Bitcoin.
Exactly. So what Coinbase informed about 13,000 of its customers who'd cut. Now, what the reporting said, completed transactions totaling more than $20,000 through their accounts in a single year between 2013 and 2015.
So they're probably more interested in money laundering than tax evasion, it sounds like.
Yeah. And so they said that they will be complying with an IRS court order compelling it to disclose the details of those previous year transactions. Of course, that's kind of sticky because these are these are years that for which people have already filed their taxes. And yikes, you want to make sure, that you, declared those back then. I don't know what happens if you amend a back return in that way. It's probably going to upset things. Anyway, in an email and on its website last Friday, Coinbase noted that it had, quote, fought this summons in court in an effort to protect its customers and the industry as a whole, they wrote, from unwarranted intrusions from the government. But they ended up losing in court. And so they added that a court order requires us to produce information specific to your account. Including taxpayer IDs, names, dates of birth, addresses, and transaction records from that period. So you're right, Leo. The fact that it's a limit of 20,000 suggests maybe what they're looking for is major, egregious, large bulk transfers through Bitcoin and Coinbase. Mm-hmm. I guess probably most people would be staying under that limit in terms of transactions. If and when I ever attempt to liquidate mine, I will certainly declare the taxes without question because,
why take a chance?
One has to. Yeah,
Coinbase says it's 13,000 users. So, that's not every. That's a small number, I'm sure.
Yeah. So Android P is the next version of Android. I guess it's expected at this year's upcoming Google I/O Developer Conference, May 8th through 10th in Mountain View. And I was chuckling because it'd be nice if the P edition stood for privacy. And at least, do we know? Is it always a dessert?
Yeah.
Couldn't be pancake. So
no.
What's a P dessert? Has there already been speculation?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of them.
I guess there would be. Okay. Anyway, we've talked extensively about app permissions in Android, about the sometimes overly broad permission requests. In fact, there's a couple people are working on Android clients for Squirrel, and there was just some recent discussion in our news group about, an initial beta of the Android client or one Android client for Squirrel that was asking for more than it looked like it needed, and it's just because the framework had those things defaulted, and so he quickly, pared it down to almost nothing, which is nice. Overly broad permissions, about permission auditing and management, and also, of course, about how background applications, which are loaded but which you haven't been using for some time, can be used potentially to stealthily monitor and spy. So according to the Android Open Source Project, AOSP, to a recent commit to that, Google is working on two built-in features that will be part of Android P, meant to protect its users from malicious apps spying on them while they're spying on them using the smartphone's camera or microphone. The XDA developers saw this, and essentially it notices whether it identifies apps by the UID, the unique ID of the app. And if the app is running in the background for more than a certain amount of time, and that wasn't specified, but, probably you switch away from it and after some length of time, a few seconds, because you're no longer using it. And if you don't switch back within a certain length of time, it loses access to the camera. If the app continues to try to regain access, that will then generate an error, an explicit error from the app. And as for the microphone, what Google is doing is simply muting the mic. It just returns zeros in the audio stream so that no audio, the app continues to believe it's receiving, but it's just gone silent, which sort of makes sense because it's, you know, you put it behind other apps and you're doing something else. So anyway, just nice to see that, you know, Google is moving forward and responding in, you know, to its users' privacy concerns and in a way that doesn't probably interfere with anybody. I remember, was it Stuxnet? There was some time ago, there was some malware that was signed with a valid certificate. And that got us all up in a frenzy at the time.
Oh, yeah, from Turkey. Yeah.
Yeah, and remembered like some legitimate manufacturer was broken into in the dead of night, and we believed that the certificate was stolen and that was then used to sign some high-profile malware in order to allow it to, like, you know, get used. Well, those were the quaint old days, Leo.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It turns out that nowadays, malicious code signing certificates are no longer stolen. They are created. There's a threat intelligence firm, Recorded Future, which dug into the underground certificate supply industry, of which there now is one, and came up with some surprising discoveries. First of all, for purchase through several organizations on the DL, you can get valid certificates, validly signed, registered in the names of real corporations, which, I mean, simply by paying some dollars. Most certificates are no longer being stolen from legitimate organizations. They are using the legitimate credentials of unaware corporate entities, and someone is arranging to mimic the corporation in order to cause a legitimate company. Examples were Komodo, Thought, and Symantec as certificate authorities that were behind signing these certificates that were legitimate but spoofed. So essentially what's happening is someone is arranging to spoof the identities of the requests and non-stolen legitimate certificates are being issued. And because technically the owning, or at least the company of record for the certificate, doesn't know that it was done behind their back by an authority in good standing that thought it was doing the right thing, these certificates can live for years, for however long the cert's natural life is, typically 2 or 3 years. It turns out that, of course, as we know, the reason this is being done is that legitimately signed code, it turns out in various studies that have been done, is up to twice as likely to pass unnoticed through antiviral systems. You know, antivirus systems, as we know, have become very heuristic in nature. They're making judgment calls, basically. And so one of the signals that they judge on is whether the code is signed. And EV signing, not surprisingly, makes the AV systems even more happy and less prone to give a warning. EV certificates often suppress the smart screen warnings in Windows, for example. So signing is extremely effective in obfuscating malware from analysis. Okay, so what do these things cost? 3 years ago, back in 2015, These non-stolen, created-to-order code signing certs first became widely available to the criminal underground. The most affordable version of a code signing certificate can be had for $300. So on the low end is an authentic code cert for $300. At the high end is an EV certificate with a smart screen reputation rating, which can be had for $1,600.
So that's less than I pay for my EV certificates, my real ones.
Yes.
My real ones.
Yes.
So why buy a real one when you get a forged one free? Cheap.
You've got to deal with the dark underbelly internet, of course.
But we'd EVs are thousands of dollars. $1,699, that's cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes with a pre-built-in smart screen reputation rating.
Damn straight.
Allow it to just get installed by your customers. Unfortunately, you know, it wouldn't bear your company's name. Who know? I mean, I would love to know, like, what types of companies. I wouldn't be surprised if they're legitimate-looking organizations, so that if someone did drill into their cert, although, you know, no one does, and that's another aspect of our UI, which we've talked about before, has become, you know, they're beginning to be like, oh, no one really cares about, you know, who signs their certs. Well, it would be interesting to see what company names are being borne by these fraudulent but legitimately and freshly minted certificates, just, you know, to see. Somehow they would have to be companies where spoofing could be arranged, where all of the verifications which a major CA would go about performing could be intercepted or somehow spoofed. Maybe there are insiders inside some corporations that are, you know, getting a piece of the action to facilitate certificates being minted in their company's names. To me, that seems a little more likely than you know, going to, because remember, any company can ask for a certificate from one of these from one of these issuers. So we have that same sort of trust everyone approach to this. If the certificate is signed by a legitimate entity, then the certificate itself is legitimate, then it passes muster. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting that it's no longer the case that you need to, you know, hack or steal an existing certificate in order to get something signed. If you've got the money, you know, a lot of bad guys don't. They want to do this on the cheap. And so maybe hacking is easier, but you can just purchase certificates now on the dark web. Okay, now, in what has got to be one of the cooler hacks to come along, our friend of the podcast, John Graham Cumming, he tweeted, he said, the beauty of at Cloudflare Workers, which is a technology that they have, so-called Cloudflare Worker, like threads essentially, is that it was easy to integrate Troy Hunt's new Pwned password service to add a header indicating whether a posted password is pwned or not. Then the server can warn the user. Okay, so let's back out of that a little bit and understand what this means. So we've got Cloudflare, that is, of course, a terrific CDN front end behind which websites operate. What Cloudflare is now doing, I should back up and say that Troy Hunt, who runs the haveibeenpwned.com site, he added an API which allows something to query to see whether a specific password is in his, was it like 5-point-some-million password list? 501. millions. So not low millions, high 501 unique passwords. So now what Cloudflare is doing is when a form is submitted with an HTTP post, which is the way you submit forms, that contains a username and password, their edge technology in the so-called Cloudflare worker looks at the form being submitted, sees whether there is a password in the post field, and if so, submits a query to Troy's API to see whether the password being submitted is on Troy's list of pwned passwords. If so, a header, an HTTP request header, is added on the fly to that query as it then travels on to the server running behind Cloudflare's front edge, meaning that anyone running a website which is hosted on Cloudflare could easily add some technology on their, you know, login or create an account handler to check for the presence of that header. It's CF-password-pwned header. If that's there, then that tells any site behind Cloud who's being hosted on Cloudflare that maybe they should consider notifying their user who is in the process of creating an account or presumably logging in, maybe if it already exists, that this password may not be safe to use. So very, very nifty and cool service. Troy himself, upon knowing about this, learning about this, he tweeted, "I think this is one of the coolest use cases I've seen for pwned passwords yet." He says, it's a at Cloudflare worker, he says, parens, codes that runs in their edge nodes that can automatically check a password on form posts, such as login, and add a response header indicating pwnage. He says, that's awesome. So hats off to the guys at Cloudflare. They keep coming up with neat ways to make their service even more useful and terrific. And Troy, for his part, just launched Pwned Passwords version 2 and this is where I got the 501. He says, with half a billion passwords for download, he actually does offer a torrent, and he asks people to please use the torrent. It's hosted by Cloudflare. So if you download this thing, I remember it's like 8 gigs. So if everybody individually downloads the 8 gig file, that's a load on Cloudflare's bandwidth. So he says, please use the torrent if you can. So last Thursday, in a long and wonderfully detailed posting, and for anyone who's interested, I've got the link in the show notes, but you can just also Google the phrase Troy Hunt : I've just launched Pwned Passwords v2, and that'll take you to his page. For anyone who's interested in this topic, I'm not going to go into it in detail. He wrote this fantastic, lengthy sort of update on the whole world of this password pwnage and what he's been doing with it, and the service he offers, and the statistics, all kinds of really interesting and cool statistics that he's collected over time. I grabbed one paragraph from that. He wrote, in total, there were 3 billion 33 million 858,815 occurrences. Of those, 501,636,804 unique passwords. So again, a little over 3 billion occurrences of those 500+ million unique passwords. He says, in other words, on average, each password appeared 6 times across various data breaches. In some cases, the same password appeared many times in the one incident, often thousands of times, because that's how many people choose the same damn password, he wrote. So obviously, and hopefully this is just historically, because we should all now be using random gibberish passwords. People don't. But so what he's got is really interesting statistics. He's done a cross correlation of password reuse across breaches. And as he said, on average, each password appeared 6 times across various data breaches. And in some cases, thousands of times, not because, well, it couldn't be thousands of users because you've only got, you know, one user at most per breach. So lots of password reuse. Anyway, so cool service from Cloudflare, and again, a neat service from Have I Been Pwned. And remember that haveibeenpwned.com allows you to safely put your actual password, yours, into the Have I Been Pwned webpage. It is SHA-1 salted and hashed by JavaScript running in your browser. So that password is immediately encrypted, essentially, hashed, you know, well enough. And Troy defends his use of SHA-1, which is plenty strong for this application. So it is salted and hashed, sent to him, where it is then securely compared against this half a billion previously disclosed passwords. So you can securely check whether your password has leaked in any of these known breaches in the past. So very, very cool stuff. As I mentioned at the top, someone tweeting as Very Stable Genius sent to both me and to you, Leo. He said, "Diebold." It's
Diebold.
Not Diebold.
It's spelled D-I-E. Diebold.
Yes. And
anyway, sure, I was glad to get that correction.
Diebold to me, but yeah. Not Diebold. No. He says, "As a former employee who has written you several times over the years with this same request, please, I beg you, please." This is where we're not sure that it was a good thing for Twitter to expand the length of tweets. But "stop making me cringe every time the name is mispronounced.
Smiley face. Joe.
Love the podcasts." Right. No, Guaijo.
I'm glad to get the correction because I want to say it right too. And I actually, it's like GIF and GIF. I say it both ways to cover my bases.
Yep.
So I
now know
it's Diebold.
And please perk up when you see me stomp on it again. I'm sure that our very stable genius will. But anyway, I will do my best.
Steve is
Diebold.
Diebold.
You know, why did they spell it Diebold if they wanted people to pronounce it Diebold?
Probably somebody's
name.
I'm
sure some guy's name.
Yeah.
And Michael Horowitz, who writes the defensive computing column and has a great site about router configuration, added, this is also in errata. He said, "Steve, what you said on the last Security Now about DNS servers was not the whole story. Remember, I was answering the question about whether if you configured your DNS in your router and differently in your computer, who won the war? And I stated that by default, obtain IP address automatically and obtain DNS servers automatically was what computers did. So if you changed what was being sent in your router, then that's what everybody would use. But I said you could override that by manually inputting an IP address and or DNS servers in your computer. So Michael corrects me. He says peplink routers can override all DNS requests from devices connected to their routers. In this case, you will use, you will use the DNS servers in the router, not those hard-coded in your computer. From the perspective of the router, it's easy. He says, just look for outgoing port 53 traffic. And of course, he's correct. It's UDP. It's unencrypted. It is instantly easy to find. It's going to be a port 53 query. And so you simply rewrite the destination IP in the packet as it's transiting from the LAN to the WAN outbound, and the router wins in that case. Now, if you got really fancy with something like an OpenDNS, where you were setting up a TCP connection or encrypting your stuff, then that changes the game. But of course, then you're using OpenDNS and not just arbitrarily trying to use a different router. So thank you, Michael, for the clarification.
See, and I'm puzzled by this because isn't there a DNS cache in the computer? Wouldn't that be sufficient? And the host file, don't those get referred to first? And if they come up with a response, doesn't the computer just stop?
Well, yes, but if the folks say, so the host file is static, and if you do put things in there, it absolutely wins.
That wins. And a cache wins. If it's in the cache, it's going to win, right?
But the cache is always started from scratch.
When you reboot.
When you reboot.
But I think that's important because if...
It also times out.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, because all DNS will drain over time. DNS records have a TTL, a time to live, which is like sometimes it's a day, sometimes it's a week, sometimes it's an hour.
That's the point.
Varies.
If your cache gets poisoned, it's gonna win every time,
yes,
right?
Yes, it'll stay poisoned for a while. Yes.
Okay. So I mean, I set it in my router, of course.
Yes.
And I think if you set in the router, barring that, a host file or cache poisoning, well, but then, the computer setting isn't going to make any difference if you have that kind of router.
So, exactly. And Michael did add another router. I saw another tweet from him, but it passed by and I didn't catch it. So there are routers, where you are able to override... I've not seen this in any typical consumer routers, but the peplink is a router that offers the feature. And the point is, from a technology standpoint, it's not difficult to do. If the router has the feature, it would be able to intercept anything that was outbound.
And overwrite it. Yeah.
And yes.
Got it. So if it had the feature, it would overwrite anything, including a DNS cache.
Exactly.
Well, wait a minute, though. There's no cache query. It's just – no, because the router's not seeing a cache query. It's just seeing 192.
But the first time the first computer – yes.
Yes. So it isn't – So it isn't that straightforward. The cache wins and then hosts.
Actually, hosts.
Hosts. No, I bet cache is first just for speed, Steve. You're not going
to
look.
You know, in every instance when I've made a change to my hosts file, it wins instantly.
Okay.
So I think it looks there even before it looks for caching.
Okay.
Yeah. We were talking about Ubiquiti routers, and a couple people asked me about hardware offloading. And so I wanted to talk about that just because it's something we've never discussed on this podcast. And I have a link to a really nice page about it on the Ubiquiti site for anyone who is interested. And it's significant because it turns out that the long time ago, back in the DDoS era, when people were like doing SYN floods, we talked about how the SYN packets, S-Y-N, the synchronized packets that are used to start TCP, they were damaging or difficult to handle because they were so small. What that meant was that a given amount of bandwidth could carry a very high packet rate. And so it was oftentimes the per packet handling capability that was the limiting factor. So a router that could handle, say, 100 megs of legitimate data could be brought to its knees by much less bandwidth of pure little tiny 60-byte SYN packets because they were so small. That is, there were things that the router did per packet. And if the packets were tiny, many more of them could be sent per unit of time than legitimate regular data-bearing packets. Well, this is all, of course, well-known to router manufacturers. So one of the things that network adapters have long done and that routers do too is known as hardware offloading. Because, for example, every single internet packet has a checksum. It's a simple-minded checksum. It's a one's complement checksum where you just sum all of the packets and don't worry about overflows. And once sum all of the bytes of the packet. And once you've done that, you stick the checksum in the packet. And the idea is that when any other device receives it, that device sums up all the bytes and verifies the checksum in order to do a simple-minded, were any bits altered in transit? Well, the point is that takes time, and that's a dumb use of the main CPU, the CPU in our computers. So for a long time, checksumming of packets is something that the hardware in our NICs, in our network interface cards or network interface controllers did for us. If just like, so the idea was that the OS driver for the hardware knew that the hardware was capable of doing hardware checksumming. And so it let the packet go right by without bothering to itself to fix, as it's building the packet, without bothering to put the checksum in the packet, knowing that the hardware itself will do that with zero overhead. It can do it at, you know, register speed so that essentially the software is offloaded from that responsibility. Well, the same thing happens with routers. More advanced router hardware has the ability of doing various levels of hardware offloading, in some cases even involving encryption and encryption verification and signature verification of encrypted payloads. And interestingly, the Ubiquiti routers, many of them, even the Edge Router X, has that capability. It may not be turned on by default. So last week we were talking about a router where the throughput that was measured was, I think it was down in the 400 megabits, and for a given router, and when that listener of ours switched routers to a beefier router, they were able to get right up near the 1 gig that they believed their router, that their connection was able to handle. I did see in this documentation, and again, if you're running a Ubiquiti Edge router that we've talked about, you might want to check out this link. Probably you could Google Edge Router Hardware Offloading Explained, and I would bet that Google will take you to the Ubiquiti page, which is very comprehensive. But they have in their firmware the ability to turn on hardware offloading, and everybody will get a substantial benefit if that's done.
Why is that not on by default?
because their page does say that their firmware is a little skittish about it for some reason. And so if there's any compatibility problem created, they want to make sure that users can like say, oops, whatever I did, that just broke something. And so they're able to back out of it.
I have to try this because a couple things on the Edge Router X. One, somebody in the chat room says it does support that peplink thing that we were talking about of enforcing DNS.
Interesting. And I really do like that little router. It is a kick butt little router.
Thank you, Web9462. I think Neo said PFSense will also do that, of course.
Yeah, not surprisingly.
If PFSense didn't, I'd be shocked. I actually took my Edge Router X out of service because I was noticing periodic, very brief dropouts of internet access. They were just going away. And it was really bothering the Roku. For some reason, Roku does not handle it well.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you have a streaming device. It doesn't want to lose.
Well, and there wasn't still enough in the buffer. Well, I might try this hardware offloading. That might actually fix the problem. But taking it out of service and just using a different router fixed it. But
And I was going to say that even if you're not saturating your connections, the hardware offloading could substantially reduce latency.
Right.
And of course, that's the buffer bloat problem, and latency is bad, especially for any kind of real-time streaming stuff. So
I don't really need it. So I was just playing with it on your recommendation. So I'm just going to let the...
Roku is your choice of streaming.
No, it's just one of many.
Oh, that's right. I did hear you say that on one of the other podcasts. Like, no, I got them all.
I have them all. We often use Roku. On my 4K TV, I have the Roku Ultra, Chromecast Ultra, and the new Apple TV. All three do 4K quite well, although the Apple TV is probably the best of the bunch. But Apple TV doesn't support all the channels Roku does, and vice versa. So you need to have at least those two.
Apple TV's controller is the worst thing.
It's awful, isn't it?
My God.
Yeah. The Roku is nice, and it has a headphone jack if you want kind of private
listening. Isn't that freaky? It's bizarre that you plug the headphone jack into the remote control.
Yeah.
And you get your audio.
Yeah, so I'm very I use the Roku probably more than any of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Apple TV's remote controller is the epitome of the failure of form over function. Because oh my God, is it awful. I just went back to Amazon, the Fire TV, because I finally got tired of fighting with Apple's controllers. Like it's so bad.
Yeah.
I got a nice – actually, this is a three-note chain. I don't think I've ever shared one before, but I thought it was kind of fun because it just sort of highlighted a SpinRite customer's interaction with GRC. I've talked about Sue and Greg from time to time. They've both been with me for decades now. A customer named David Stidolf. I hope Stidolf. Anyway, David, sorry if I mangled your name. Stidolf. He wrote on the 17th. He said, "Hello, my name is David Stidolf. I have been a long all caps time user of SpinRite, but I have an immediate need. I need to recover a laptop drive, and I cannot find my ISO." He says, "Any chance I can download it again?" He says, "My current email is." And I redacted it from the show notes, but it's a Gmail account. Then he said, my previous email was, and again, I took it out. It was a Roadrunner account, which he says is no longer active. And he says, if I cannot download it, please let me know. Thanks, David. So Sue got his email, responded, "Hi, David. Your original receipt with download instructions has just been sent via email. Your transaction code in your emailed receipt is the key to your download. It will allow you to obtain replacement copies as well as edit your own contact email should it need to be changed. Sincerely, GRC, Sales Department." And then he responded in a third mail with he thanks Sue, and he said, "Wanted to pass on a SpinRite story. My first PC was a 4.77. Of course, we all know that meant megahertz. Clone with a 5 megabyte MFM hard drive. He says, when it powered up, it sounded like a small jet engine. He said, I got a copy of SpinRite, don't recall whether it was 1.0 or 2.0, and ran it on that machine. Not only did it recover bad sectors, it quieted the drive down quite a bit. Go figure. He said, since then, I have saved many hard drives over the years. The software rocks. Best of luck. I hope you guys sell lots. David Steindorf. And nice. Of course, he did receive the ability to download a copy. That's true of all of our customers. We have a database. Sue's able to query the database based on whatever information a customer can provide and can then re-enable their ability to download the product. I have a feeling once 6.1 starts to become available, Sue's going to be very busy helping people to regain access to so they're able to download their free upgrade to 6.1. Nice. I'm not looking forward to that, but our customers are. So a few closing the loop bits. So Stefan Corrivo, whose Twitter handle is No Thumb Bowler. I don't know what that means.
He has no thumb.
And he bowls. But he bowls.
So he's a three-finger bowler.
A three-finger, okay. The bowling balls have four holes? I don't know.
I believe. Anyway. Yes, they do. Or three.
So your pinky holes. Doesn't go in?
They have three holes. Three holes.
Ah, that's right. That sort of feels right.
Three holes. your index finger and your middle finger.
Maybe he holds the bowl with both hands and then rolls
it
down.
That's how I do it.
Yeah.
Throw it down.
So he says, I'm not looking forward to the day that many domains are using different crypto mining and my browser with multiple tabs is rendered useless since each domain will want 90% of my CPU and degrade my internet experience. Well, the good news is, well, I'm sure when that happens, non-current tabs will not have the miners running still. So, this will get managed. I mean, this could be a passing fad, this idea of permitted mining to replace advertising revenue. I don't know. I think it's going to, if it doesn't die before it can be made efficient, I think it might make sense. We'll see. But in any event, the browsers will certainly become aware if this becomes a thing, and it will only be the page your eyeballs are viewing at the moment, which has mining running on it. So when you switch away, that'll be shut down, I'm sure. Anthony tweeted, Bluehost wanted me to provide the last four characters of my password for identification. Does that mean they have my plain password? He says, I thought password is hashed in the DB. Well, that's sort of an interesting hack. I meant to add a screenshot that Anthony provided, or I guess I went to get it, or maybe both, because it was interesting. They were, in fact, asking for the last four characters of his password. And this could be done securely. So when he originally provided them with his password, they would have received the whole thing. They could have hashed the whole password and saved that, and then hashed the last four characters and saved it separately. So they've got two hashes. They've got the full password hash, and they have a little verification hash stored separately. Access requires the whole password, but identification, and I don't understand quite the use case of that. I didn't see why it was that they would want identification without full password, but I mean, it's sort of legitimate. It could weaken the whole system because a bad guy could separately attempt to guess just the last four characters. As we know, there are many fewer possibilities to guess in just four characters. Maybe that would allow them then to spoof this identification phase, whatever that is. Maybe that was, that wouldn't be password recovery. Anyway, I don't know why they would want that. But it could potentially then give an attacker a bit of a leg up, because then they could separately verify a piece of the password from the whole, and then have those four removed from the whole, although they still wouldn't know what the whole was and would then have to guess that. So an interesting hack, but it does not mean, to answer Anthony's question, that the whole thing would have to be stored in the clear. It could have just been set up that way in the beginning. They say the last four characters when they were hashing the whole thing.
I kind of like that idea, actually, because it kind of splits the baby. You get a way of verifying without them knowing the full password.
Yep. And, you know, for what it's worth, Squirrel has that built in, too.
Oh, really?
We call it the quick pass.
That's
the idea being that the first time you sit down at your computer, you need to enter your whole password in order to decrypt your identity. But then it immediately re-encrypts your identity using just the first four characters. And so that subsequently, you're able to just go bing, 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 bing. Oh, and you can change four. You can adjust it up or down to suit your taste. So as you are re-authenticating yourself with Squirrel over the course of the next few hours or the day, you know, like whatever, a session, you're able to just give it the beginning of your password, a pin, exactly. Yeah. And it there very quickly says, okay, it's still him. But if you miss, that is, you can't guess wrong once, you don't get those first four right, the first thing Squirrel does is wipe that hint data out of RAM and then says, oops, you're going to have to, you know, reprove your identity. But that's just entering your whole password in order to say, oops, sorry, I was just a typo. But sort of a nice trade-off of convenience and security, I think. One that we haven't seen before, except, you know, these guys are doing it for something, which is kind of cool, too. Stephen Pickering says, hey, Steve, I'm in the market for a new Mac, but I hate the idea of buying a new computer that has a patch on its CPU for Meltdown Inspector, which, from my understanding, hampers performance. Is mine a valid reticence? Thanks. You're the best. And he also included at Leo Laporte in the tweet. So, so it's probably the case that until a next generation processor with this updated microcode is shipped from Intel, that all existing processors will be patched. And, you know, the design pipeline is years long. So it may be 2, 3, 4 years before they would be able to update a processor the already in manufacturing. I don't know. But you could imagine they could retrofit patched firmware for existing currently manufactured chips so that they start carrying the patch themselves. But it's not the patch, and this is the key, not the patch that hampers performance. It's the fact that we've had to give up something we had. The patch gives software the control that it has not previously had that is necessary for security. And it's the security change, the security fix, which is causing us some performance loss. So essentially, until recently, and this is why I don't hold Intel responsible. I mean, we've all been, the whole industry has been benefiting from the fact that we were doing something, and we meaning everyone, all processors, the entire computing industry, has been doing something that wasn't technically secure in getting a big performance win in trade. Well, now the bad guys have figured out how to leverage that insecurity, that vulnerability, and so we're having to back off of some performance that was nice to have, but now, unfortunately, we can't have it anymore. So future processors will incorporate the patch, and software will use that in order to throttle performance a little bit in the name of security. But we were sort of getting away with something for a long time that, you know, that was fine until the academic researchers said, whoopsie, actually it was Google's Project Zero, said, Intel, you know, we can read RAM in other processes. Did you know that?
Apple says that the benchmarks show almost, or let's see the exact, no measurable performance reduction for their Meltdown mitigations. They did the Spectre mitigations in Safari. And on two Safari benchmarks, on browser benchmarks, one has no measurable impact. One has less than 2.5%. That's the Jetstream benchmark. So good. I don't think you're missing a whole lot on a modern Mac. And that's the point. In fact, they aren't even fixing the older Macs. I think they're just going to let those go because that's where you'd take a big hit. Right. And by the way, it's not just Macs. It's any PC. I mean, I think you'd have some reticence on any PC, any modern PC, right?
Yes.
But I think Apple's done a good job, and it sounds like they don't believe it's much of a hit.
Right.
Modern PCs are so fast.
Leo. We're so spoiled.
Yeah. Make sure you get an SSD. That makes a bigger difference than anything else.
Yeah.
And lots of RAM, you know?
Yeah. So a few mining questions, which leads us into our discussion of WebAssembly. Nick Stoller said, regarding JavaScript mining, wouldn't WebGL allow pretty efficient mining without building it into the browser? And I'll respond to that because that's, well, in fact, then Michael, who tweets from Krabby127, said, on Security Now, you keep mentioning how browser-based mining are currently terrible because JavaScript is inefficient. What about WebGL that leverages the GPU directly? Love the show. Okay, so both Nick and Michael, WebGL does give browsers access to the graphics processing unit, but not for raw hashing, which is what we want. The WebGL accelerates, WebGL primitives, making them run much faster. So graphics-y things like blitting areas or fast vector computations or 3D permutation and matrix multiplications, those primitives which high-end graphics processing needs, that's what's accelerated on the GPU. What mining needs is just raw brute force hashing. And so that will be the innovation that I hope we'll see, is that there will be some extension of web hash or web crypto or who knows what we'll call it, which gives browser code access to GPUs for hashing. That will be the thing that then gives us, you know, really good performance and leverages the GPUs that are sitting around looking for something to do most of the time, you know, relatively speaking. So finally, two of our listeners, Sebastian, I hope this is Boisvert, B-O-I-S-V-E-R-T. What do I think that? Boisvert? Probably, maybe the T is silent. I don't know. Anyway, Sebastian, sorry I mangled your last name. And Andreas said, oh, so Sebastian said, would WebAssembly make web crypto mining more practical? Andreas asked, he said, second week in a row, you talk about JavaScript being way too inefficient for crypto mining. What about, for example, WebAssembly? And then he gives me the URL, webassembly.org. So I wanted to address this just to wrap up this week's podcast. WebAssembly is better than JavaScript, but still worse than native code. It is a standard. It is definitely on the way to happening. The first benchmark is called the MVP, the minimum viable.
Usually product, sometimes program.
Minimum viable
product.
Protocol. I can't remember what P stood for in this case. MVP of WebAssembly.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Protocol. Anyway.
It's very commonly used in startups. Just the minimum viable product.
Right. Yeah. So what they're doing is they're okay. So WebAssembly. And Leo, you'll connect to this because I know you've always been interested in stack machines like Forth is. WebAssembly is a stack-based virtual machine. So it is not that there was the experiment that we talked about a few years ago that Google did where they were using a restricted subset of Intel assembly language, or Intel machine language, actually, which they had managed through an amazing amount of work. I mean, I was so in awe where they were sort of able to sandbox native Intel code and arrange to keep it from doing anything dangerous. Well, that was cool because it was then running on the bare metal. I mean, it was actually native code. Well, the problem is it was also Intel chip specific. And in this day and age, while Intel is the current leader, as we know, ARM is on the rise. You know, ARM isn't going away. And so it didn't make sense to standardize on a single manufacturer's native code. So what WebAssembly is it is a binary format, meaning that it is binary code that is downloaded. It also has a assembly code looking text format, and it is executable in web pages. It's becoming universally supported. Is now in the hands of the World Wide Web Consortium with engineers from Mozilla, Microsoft, Google, and Apple. So it's going to happen. It is compiled currently from C and C++. So you start with C and C++ code. It is, however, it can be targeted at other high level languages in the future. So C and C++ compiles to WebAssembly, but it is bytecode, as the term is. It is interpreted bytecode. The reason it's interesting is that it is very compact. It runs fast, and the goal is to approach native machine code speed. It isn't there yet because, again, you need an interpreter. So there's a layer of interpretation which is emulating a virtual machine, a virtual stack-based machine, which reads the bytecode and does things with it. So there's still a layer of translation there. But for web browsers, the reason it really wins is that it is very small, so it downloads fast, and it can start running the instant it arrives. JavaScript is ASCII. You know, it's script, it's text. So we've got all of these JITs, all these just-in-time compilers and JavaScript interpreters. And to their credit, they're doing an amazing job. But the code comes down as text and then has to essentially be interpreted / compiled. And I mean, what they've done is an amazing amount of work. But think about it. Every single time some big node.js blob is downloaded or any JavaScript is downloaded anywhere, It is going into a browser, and all of that work is having to be done redundantly by every single person that downloads it. What WebAssembly has done is, I think, very cleverly, they've moved that work to the other side of the connection. They've moved it to the delivery side or to the server rather than weighing down the recipient. So code gets written in a comfortable high-level language like C. It's compiled into WebAssembly, and it's a pre-compiled, ready-to-run binary blob. Yes, it's not native code, but the advantage of that is it can run on any processor that has a browser that runs WebAssembly, and they're all going to. So what we're going to see is, I think we will over time see a shift away from JavaScript to WebAssembly, because it'll just make sense. What the user experience will be is snappier applications. You know, it'll just the moment the page is there, the code is running. It's not running at native speed, but it's running faster than JavaScript. But mostly, it's starting up instantly. So it makes a lot of sense. It gets us closer to the hardware. Still, in order to have chip independence, it's going to be a virtual stack machine, which is now well defined. It may be moving forward in the future as it evolves. So there will be version 1, version 2, and so forth. But what we really need is we need GPU hashing support in our browsers. When we get that, either by an extension maybe or native in the browser, that'll give us high-speed crypto mining capability managed then by the browser. WebAssembly, nice step forward. It is happening in the industry, but it's not, and it's probably a better solution for mining than JavaScript, but not the same as running native code. So that's the tune-up on WebAssembly. We haven't really talked about it much. We talked about it once before, but it's really moving forward, and it's going to end up becoming a substantial. I mean, I think it's going to largely replace JavaScript in the future because it just makes sense.
And it's server side, not client side.
Correct. Right now with JavaScript, everybody who downloads a page with JavaScript has to essentially compile it, and in order to run it, it makes much more sense to do that once, for the web developers to do that once, and then just offer a much smaller pre-compiled binary which downloads and then just drops in and it's ready to run in a on the WebAssembly virtual machine, essentially. Very cool.
Interesting idea. And you can find out more about it. They have a WebAssembly.org page.
Yep.
Where they describe the MVP, minimum viable product, is what they've got.
Ah, okay. Perfect. Thank you.
It was the first, conceptual version of it.
Yep.
And that was the tank game. If you were watching on video, I was playing as written in WebAssembly. And it was pretty snappy using WebGL.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah. Well, Steve, we've come to the end of this fabulous, gripping edition of Security Now. I've been gripped.
Hold on to your whatever you need to grip.
I hope you've been gripped as well. We do this show every Tuesday right after Mac Break Weekly around about 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. I'd love it if you stop by and say hi. You could either do that at twit.tv/live. That's the live video stream. You can listen on any of your voice-enabled devices. Just ask for Twit Live. The syntax depends, and it's changed apparently. On Amazon Echo, you have to now say, listen to Tune In Twit Live for some reason. But that works. You can also be in studio. Email tickets at twit.tv. We'll make sure there's a chair out for you. And if you can't watch live or be here live, you can always see the on-demand product. Steve keeps it at his website, grc.com. That's where you can get the 64 kilobit audio plus the
nice transcriptions that Elaine Ferris does, so you can read along as you listen or search. It's a great way to jump right into the show. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN, for Security Now. And Steve's at SGGRC on Twitter. I know a lot of people talk to him that way, so that's a good way to reach him. Or grc.com/feedback. While you're at GRC, please pick up a copy of Spin Right. You'll get a copy of Six the minute it's done. You can also read about Squirrel, all sorts of stuff, grc.com. Everything's free except Spin Right, but that's the one you want to pay for. So there you go. And Steve will be back next week to discuss the latest in security. Thank you,
yes,
Steve.
Sir. Who knows what's in store for us?
Evil lurks in the hearts of hackers.
We'll catch
the
up
Gibson
next
knows.
See you. Thanks, then, buddy.
Bye. Security.